proof of what you just said. When the 1st Marine Division landed on Guadalcanal, Stecker landed on Tulagi, across the channel from Guadalcanal, as a major, commanding 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. Shortly after that, he was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel on Guadalcanal. And earlier today, there was a special channel personal message to Pickering from the Secretary of the Navy. A paragraph of that informed him that Stecker was shortly going to be transferred to Washington and was promoted to full colonel. Colonel Stecker took McCoy's meaning and grew uncomfortable. His promotion and transfer meant that he would not be going into the Philippines. Two things were wrong with that. Personally, he'd rather go to the Philippines than to Washington. He thought he might be of some genuine use there. He wasn't at all sure that would be true in Washington. And secondly, although he would have been happy to publicly announce that Ken McCoy was one hell of a Marine officer, he thought that by sending him in alone to the Philippines, Pickering was placing more responsibility on his shoulders than he should really ask of a 22-year-old. Pickering nodded. "Precisely," he said. "And Fertig, being an outstanding officer, does not fit in with the picture El Supremo, and especially Willoughby, want to paint of him now."
"You've lost me, Flem," Stecker said.
"It is their official position that setting up guerrilla activities in the Philippines is impossible, unless, of course, they set them up at some unspecified time in the future. And here comes this guy, a reservist, who announces that he has recruited people, set up U.S. forces in the Philippines, and appointed himself as commanding general. Then says that as soon as we can get him the material to do it with, he will commence guerrilla activities against the Japanese. Since it wasn't their idea, obviously it's bad. And so is this guy. And if he succeeds, he will make Willoughby, and by inference El Supremo himself, look foolish."
"You're not suggesting they hope Fertig will fail?" Stecker asked.
"I think that's a possibility, Jack, that we should keep in mind," Pickering said.
"Did you call Willoughby on this?" Stecker asked.
"You bet I did. He vaguely remembers hearing something about Fertig getting promoted to major, but that the records have, of course, been lost, and officially, they have to consider him as still being a captain."
"Christ," McCoy said in disgust.
"A captain who appoints himself commanding general of anything looks like somebody who may not be playing with a full deck," Pickering said. "Somebody you don't pay a lot of attention to, or more importantly, send arms and ammunition to. It's a hell of a lot different when the fellow is a highly regarded lieutenant colonel."
"According to Phil Dupre, Fertig is a good officer," Stecker said.
"And I'm sure he's told Willoughby that," Pickering replied. "Willoughby has selective hearing. He doesn't hear what he doesn't want to hear. But what really bothers me is wondering what else they haven't told me."
"Now I really wish I was going with McCoy," Stecker said. "Particularly with the silver chickens on my collar."
"You know that's out of the question, Jack," Pickering said.
"For the sake of argument, let's say McCoy finds Fertig and decides he's not a lunatic and can do what he says he can do. If they're ignoring what Dupre, one of their own, tells them about Fertig, what makes you think they'll listen to McCoy?
On such an important matter as this, we can't trust the judgment of a Marine lieutenant." "That's pretty simple, Jack," Pickering said. "I trust McCoy's judgment, and I'm not going to run his report of whatever he finds in the Philippines past Willoughby and company and give them a chance to snipe at it. My recommendation goes right to Frank Knox, who will lay it on Admiral Leahy's desk. Leahy trusts Knox, Knox trusts me, and I trust McCoy. So will the President, I think, once he learns, as I intend that he will, that the killer was with Roosevelt's son on the Makine Island raid." Stecker smiled.
"Okay.
But you're not supposed to call him that, you know," he said. Sorry, Ken," Pickering said.
"No offense taken, sir," McCoy said, not very convincingly.
"Okay, we're getting down the line. I just told Pluto to message Nimitz at Pearl Harbor asking for the submarine Narwhal. I think he'll give it to us. I figure 10 days, 2 weeks on the outside before we get it." Both Stecker and McCoy nodded. "Is there anything else you think you need, Ken? I'm
prepared to override the colonel here if you really want to take a Garand with you.
Nah, he's right, McCoy said. If we're going to equip the Filipinos with carbines, that's what the Americans should carry. And with a little bit of luck, I won't have to shoot anybody anyway.
I'm glad you brought that up, Ken, Pickering said. You're not being sent to shoot at the Japanese. I want your honest assessment of Colonel Fertig and his potential. If you get yourself killed, I'll do my very best not to, sir.
Back to the original question. Is there anything else you would like to take with you?
Pickering saw McCoy's eyes light up momentarily, but he said nothing.
What, Ken? If I can get it for you, it's yours.
How about a gunnery sergeant?
Anyone in particular?
We served together in China, working for Banning. He was on the Makian Island raid. I saw him on Guadalcanal. He was running the weapons shop for VMF 229.
Marine Fighter Squadron 229.
He's an old breed Marine, speaks Spanish, two or three kinds of Chinese, and even a little Japanese. I think he'd be useful. His name is Zimmerman.
What the hell is a man who speaks Spanish, Chinese, and Japanese doing repairing weapons? Pickering thought, more than a little angrily.
Give me his full name and his serial number, if you've got it, and I'll get right on it, he said, and then had a second thought.
Ken, you sure he'd volunteer for something like you're going to be doing?
McCoy smiled at him.
Tolerantly. I just asked a stupid question, and this young man is smiling tolerantly at me.
He's an old-breed Marine, General, McCoy said.
Old-breed Marines don't volunteer for anything. They go where they're told to go and do what they're told to do.
I stand corrected, Mr. McCoy, Pickering said. And if you and this other old-breed Marine here can get those weapons back together in the next hour or so, I will make amends by taking the both of you out to dinner.
2. Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff, G1, Headquarters, United States Marine Corps, 8th and I Streets, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 0915 hours, 17 November, 1942. Master Gunner James L. Hardy entered the office of Colonel David M. Wilson, waited until he had the colonel's attention, and then announced that Colonel F. L. Rickaby, Deputy Chief of the USMC Office of Management Analysis, was outside, asking to see him. Following a hand-delivered, classified, secret inter-office memorandum from the Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps, ordering that no personnel actions, read, transfers, involving officers assigned to the USMC Office of Management Analysis were to be taken without the specific approval in each instance of Major General Horace W. T. Forrest, Assistant Chief of Staff G2, Colonel Wilson and Gunner Hardy had correctly surmised that the Office of Management Analysis probably had more to do with intelligence than either management or analysis. They had no idea what it had to do with intelligence, and did not consider it their official business to make inquiries. Colonel Wilson had run into Colonel Rickaby at various times during their long service, but with the exception of the time they'd spent as students at the Naval War College, he could not recall ever knowing what Rickaby's assignments had been. Neither were Rickaby's records in the files of the officers' branch, Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff, G1. They had been borrowed a long time before by the office of the Secretary of the Navy, and never returned. There had been no reply to two requests for their return.
I haven't seen Rickaby since the War College, Wilson thought as he made a show-him-in wave of his hand to Gunner Hardy.
How are you, Fritz? Wilson said, trying to conceal his surprise that Rickaby was in civilian clothing. Long time no see.
David? Rickaby replied.
How are you? And what can I do for you?
I came here looking for Charlie Stevens, Rickaby said. He's out of the office.
Colonel Charles D. Stevens was head of the enlisted branch of the Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff, G1.
Charlie went down to Paris Island to show some congressmen around.
He and his deputy's deputy, leaving a young major in charge, Rickaby said. I didn't want to show him this, so I came to you.
He handed Wilson an obviously decrypted radio message.
Strange paper, Fritz, Wilson thought aloud as he felt the unusual, slick paper.
It burns rapidly, Rickaby said, matter-of-factly.
Top Secret, Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Navy Department, Washington, D.C. Via special channel, duplication forbidden, original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. For Colonel F. L. Rickaby, Office of Management Analysis, Brisbane, Australia, Monday, 16 November, 1942. Dear Fritz, while Jack NMI Stecker's promotion is richly deserved, it means McCoy will be going on the Fertig operation just about by himself. The man who should replace Stecker, obviously, is Banning, but that's obviously impossible. McCoy has asked me for a Chinese and Japanese-speaking gunnery sergeant who served with him in both China pre-war and was on the Makin Island raid with him. Under the circumstances, I think McCoy should have whatever he thinks he needs. Therefore, please arrange the immediate, repeat, immediate transfer of Gunnery Sergeant Ernest Zimmerman from VMF 229, which is now at EWA Hawaii, to us here. Do whatever it takes and keep me advised. Regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General USMCR. Top Secret, Eyes Only, Sec Navy.
I'm surprised you showed me this, Wilson said. It says, Eyes Only, Sec Nave.
It also says, Do Whatever It Takes, Rickaby said.
I'm also surprised that General Pickering knows that Jack NMI Stecker was promoted. That was supposed to be kept quiet.
Yeah, I know, and I know why. And I know that General Pickering knows about it because the Secretary of the Navy told him.
What's this Fertig operation?
Sorry, that's classified.
What do you expect me to do with this?
Transfer Gunny Zimmerman.
For one thing, Fritz, that sort of thing is in Charlie Stevens's basket of eggs. I handle officers. For another, even if Zimmerman was an officer, I couldn't just order his transfer on the basis of this. Who is this General Pickering anyway? What makes him think he can just wave his hand and have people transferred?
Because what he's doing has a high priority.
From whom? What kind of a priority?
To stop the flow of bureaucratic bullshit. You're telling me you won't have the gunny transferred?
Wilson's temper flared.
What I'm telling you, Colonel, he said coldly, is that I can't because I don't have the authority to summarily order the transfer of enlisted men.
As quickly as his temper had boiled over, it subsided.
Charlie will be back the day after tomorrow. You're going to have to wait until Charlie can act on your request. I'm sure his major will decide correctly he can't do it on his own authority.
Thank you for finding time for me in your busy schedule, Colonel, Rickaby said, and marched out of Colonel Wilson's office.
3. Office of the Secretary of the Navy, Washington, D.C., 10:15 hours, 17 November, 1942.
Well, look who's here.
The Secretary of the Navy said pleasantly when Colonel Rickaby walked into his outer office, trailed by Captain David Houghton.
Good morning, Colonel. We don't often see you here.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. I came to see Captain Houghton.
Morning, Fritz, Houghton said.
Anything I can do?
Secretary Knox asked.
A request from General Pickering that I need some help with, sir, Rickaby said.
Knox's eyebrows rose in question. Rickaby handed him General Pickering's special channel radio message. Knox glanced at it and handed it back.
I saw this at breakfast, he said. Is there a problem?
I had a little trouble with G1 at 8th and I, sir. The officer who handles this sort of thing is at Paris Island.
Take care of it, David,
Secretary Knox said.
Aye, aye, sir.
The Secretary of the Navy, Washington, D.C., 16 November 1942. Lieutenant General Thomas Holcomb, Commandant, United States Marine Corps, Washington. By hand. Dear General Holcomb, the Secretary of the Navy desires the immediate transfer of Gunnery Sergeant Ernest Zimmerman, USMC, presently assigned VMF 229, to the USMC Office of Management Analysis with duty station USMC Special Detachment 16, Brisbane, Australia, and further desires that travel be accomplished by the most expeditious means available. Respectfully, David W. Houghton, Captain USN, Administrative Assistant to the Secretary of the Navy. 4. The White House, Washington, D.C., 1910 hours, 17 November, 1942. Admiral William D. Leahy rose quickly to his feet when Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox came into his office.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for making time in your schedule for me, he said.
My time, Admiral, like yours, is the master's time, Knox said, gesturing toward the closed door to the President's Oval Office. Well said, Mr. Secretary, Colonel William J. Donovan said, chuckling. Donovan, a stocky, silver-haired man in civilian clothing, rose from his red leather upholstered chair and offered Knox his hand.
How are you, Bill?
Knox asked.
Very well, thank you, Donovan replied, and added, as a matter of fact, I'm at the moment feeling rather chipper. I think I see a problem on the way to its solution.
Is that so? Knox said. And what problem is that?
The intractable Douglas MacArthur, Donovan said.
The director, Mr. Secretary, has come up with a suggestion the President feels has considerable merit.
Knox thought.
He called Donovan the director, not Colonel. Is that because Donovan wants it that way? Because the director reminds people that he is not just one more recalled World War I colonel, but the director of the Office of Strategic Services, on the level of J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, who also likes to be called the director? Or is it because he wants to remind me that Donovan ranks higher in the hierarchy than a lowly colonel? On the other hand, Secretary of War Stimson, who also served in France as a colonel, likes to be called colonel. The rank structure here is confused, almost certainly because Franklin Roosevelt wants it to be. Admiral Leahy is a serving officer of the Navy. I am Secretary of the Navy, therefore he is legally subordinate to me. But he is also Chief of Staff to the President. If he were de facto subordinate to me instead of de jure, this meeting would be held in my office, after he had called Houghton and asked for an appointment. I am here. Ergo, he speaks with the authority of the President.
May we speak frankly? Donovan asked. Among the three of us.
Of course, Knox said.
I am advised by my Brisbane station chief that General MacArthur has not, as of yesterday morning, found time in his schedule to receive him, despite, I am sure, the best efforts of Fleming Pickering.
You suggested we speak frankly, Knox replied.
I am advised by General Pickering, Bill, that General MacArthur does not want, how did he put it, the nose of your camel under his tent.
The President does, Donovan said abruptly. The President sent General Pickering over there with express orders to convince General MacArthur that the Office of Strategic Services has a contribution to make to SWEPO.
He has apparently been unable to do so, Donovan said.
The word you used to describe General MacArthur a moment ago was intractable, Knox said. I have every confidence that General Pickering has done his best to comply with the President's instructions.
I like Fleming Pickering, Donovan said.
That's not the way I heard it.
I offered him a job in my shop, you know, Donovan went on. He declined it.
You offered him a job at the second or third level, which was either stupidity on your part or vindictiveness. He didn't like the size of the bill you sent him in a maritime case and told you so in blunt and unmistakable terms. You are not used to being talked to like that. You didn't like it. And when he volunteered for the OSS, you put him in his place, which, in the final analysis, was stupidity. He told me the first time I met him that I should have resigned after the debacle of Pearl Harbor. I was smart enough to realize that a man who not only owns but runs the second or third largest shipping fleet in the world is both accustomed to saying exactly what's on his mind and is wholly unimpressed with political titles. I put him to work, and his performance exceeded even my high expectations.
Did you really think, Bill, that Fleming Pickering would be willing to work two or three levels down your chain of command? Knox asked.
The President is determined, Admiral Leahy said, trying to change the subject, hoping to avoid a confrontation between the two powerful men, that General MacArthur will accept the services of the OSS for the good of the war effort.
I wonder why the President doesn't simply send him a radio message to that effect, Knox asked. Because he knows, as you know and I know, that MacArthur would at best pay only lip service to such an order, Donovan replied. And at worst, with his judgment questioned, he threatened to resign. He did that twice when he was chief of staff, you know. And when it became apparent that he was about to lose the Philippines, he announced that he was going to resign his commission and go to Bataan to fight as a private soldier. Our Douglas has a flair for the dramatic.
The president, Mr. Secretary, Admiral Leahy said, is reluctant to issue General MacArthur an order that might, from his point of view, question his authority or his judgment to the point where he might, respond inappropriately.
Politics again. The carefully nurtured image of the president as commander-in-chief would be badly tarnished if any one of his senior generals or admirals resigned in protest. When that senior general was General Douglas MacArthur, the heroic defender of the Philippines, whom Roosevelt had praised so often and effusively and had awarded the Medal of Honor, the damage would be enormous. Particularly if MacArthur, still furious that the Philippines had not received supplies and that General George Marshall had effectively taken command of the Philippines away from him the moment he got on the PT boat to go to Australia, came back and started giving speeches about Roosevelt's military ineptitude. And MacArthur was fully aware he did not have to obey any orders from any one that he didn't like.
You said, Bill, you thought you have a solution to the problem, Knox said. I have one that will accomplish what everybody wants, Donovan said.
A one that the president finds very interesting, Admiral Leahy said.
I'm fully aware that you speak with the authority of the president, Admiral. Thank you very much. But if this brilliant idea has presidential approval set in concrete, I would be told about it, not asked.
Tell me, Bill, what is it you think I want? What the president wants, what Admirals Leahy and Nimitz want, what General Pickering wants.
Which is?
To assist this chap Fertig in the Philippines, Donovan said. I also suspect that in his heart of hearts, Douglas MacArthur would like to help him too. But Douglas is worried about two things. He has stated publicly that guerrilla operations in the Philippines are impossible at this time, and he doesn't want to be proved wrong. Even worse than that, from his perspective, he would hate to admit that he was wrong, that this chap Fertig does indeed exist, and then have it proved that Fertig is a lunatic. That business of his promoting himself to general is more than a little strange, and that guerrilla operations are indeed not possible. That would make him wrong twice. Douglas MacArthur doesn't like to be wrong at all.
I'm not sure I follow you, Knox said.
The first thing I thought, frankly, was to have General Pickering assigned to the OSS. That would solve a good many problems.
It would also cause some, Knox said.
Speaking frankly, as you suggested we should, not only would General Pickering rather violently object to that, but so would I.
I made that point to the President, Mr. Secretary, Admiral Leahy said. It is his feeling that General Pickering should be transferred to the OSS only as a last resort.
And what are the intermediate steps, the first resort?
Watch it, you're being sarcastic. The fact that I don't like Donovan does not make him a fool. Antagonizing him would accomplish nothing whatever.
Best case, a team of experts is sent into the Philippines, finds that Fertig is what he says he is, that, with support, he can deliver what he promises to, and once that is accomplished, MacArthur makes the announcement, gets the credit.
Okay, what's the worst case?
Fertig turns out to be a disaster, a lunatic, and the team comes out and so reports. That would make MacArthur's statement that guerrilla operations in the Philippines are impossible at this time perfectly accurate.
Bill, you're not suggesting, I hope, that the OSS take over this operation?
Would you have problems with that, Mr. Secretary? Donovan asked.
Bill, they're just about ready to go.
The colonel you were going to send in is no longer available, Donovan said. Pickering is planning on entrusting the great responsibility of evaluating this man Fertig to a lieutenant.
Frankly, Bill, I'd like to know how you came by that information, Knox said coldly.
From Admiral Leahy, Donovan said. I don't see why that should offend you. For God's sake, we're both on the same side in this war. I heard of that radio station on Mindanao through OSS channels. When I discussed this with the Admiral, he filled in the details of Pickering's involvement.
He's right, damn him. He is the director of the OSS. He has every right to access to the details of this operation.
General Pickering has great confidence in that lieutenant, Knox said. The expressions on both Colonel Donovan's and Admiral Leahy's face made it plain they had little faith in Pickering's judgment on this subject.
And they're right, too. I didn't say anything to Pickering, but I was surprised when he didn't ask Colonel Rickaby for a more senior, more experienced officer than his Lieutenant McCoy. And he knows there is a problem. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gotten into the business of arranging for that sergeant to be transferred to go with McCoy. He'd even referred to Banning, a major, as the man he'd like to send with McCoy.
All right, Bill. What are you proposing? Knox asked.
Among the Marines you have seconded to us are a major and a captain, who I want to send in with Pickering's lieutenant, Donovan said.
How do you suggest that this affect Pickering's role, his authority, and his responsibility in this operation?
Not at all. All we'll be doing is providing some assistance, Donovan said smoothly. They will not reveal their OSS association unless and until the Operation Windmill is successful. The major is fluent in Spanish. Good family. They have interests in the Banana Republics and Cuba, and he apparently has spent some time down there. He's a Princeton graduate, a reserve officer.
There are those who believe that OSS stands for Oh So Social. And it's a fact that Donovan seems to recruit his people from the Ivy League, people whose families have interests in exotic places. So what? George Patton's an aristocrat. His aide is Charlie Codman of the Boston Codmans, and they're both splendid soldiers. Franklin Roosevelt's son made the McKin Island raid, and by every definition I know he's an aristocrat. And so, for God's sake, are Fleming Pickering and his son. Why am I so antagonistic toward Donovan?
The captain's a regular, an Annapolis graduate. He served in China before the war, speaks a little Japanese, which might prove helpful. He was wounded, serving with the Marine paratroops on Tulagi during the Guadalcanal invasion. I can't see how they could be anything but helpful, Frank.
Your thinking, obviously, is that if this operation goes well, you've got MacArthur on a spot. How can he be against the OSS if your people work so well?
That's the general idea.
What will you do, Bill, if MacArthur says, in effect, I still don't want your camel's nose under my tent?
Then I'll think of something else, Donovan said.
May I tell the President how you regard Director Donovan's proposal, Mr. Secretary? Admiral Leahy asked.
With these caveats, Admiral, I will go along with Director Donovan. First, that there is no diminution whatever of General Pickering's authority.
Agreed,
Donovan said. Which means that General Pickering will have the final say once he meets these officers about whether or not they get to go.
I'm sure General Pickering will be delighted to get them.
I'm not so sure. You agree that he will have the final decision about them, about everything?
Agreed, Donovan said. I'm trying to get my nose in Douglas MacArthur's tent, Mr. Secretary, not yours.
You understand my position, Admiral?
Yes, Mr. Secretary.
Then you may inform the President that I'm willing to sign on, Knox said. And then he thought of something else.
One more thing. The present schedule will not be delayed in any way by the attachment of your two officers. As soon as I get back to my office, I will telephone the country club, where these two are sitting on their packed bags, and order them to report to Colonel Rickaby at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Knox knew what he meant by the country club. I'll arrange for their air priorities, Mr. Secretary, if Colonel Rickaby encounters a problem, Admiral Leahy said. And I will advise Admiral Nimitz, with a special channel personal, of the President's interest in this operation. That should ensure a submarine when and where General Pickering needs it.
Why do I feel I have just been talked into something I shouldn't be doing?
Thank you, Admiral, Knox said.
He got out of his chair and started for the door.
Here's their names, Frank,
Donovan said, and handed him a 3x5-inch card on which two names were typed. Knox glanced at it. Brownlee,
Major James C. III. Macklin, Captain Robert B. He recognized neither name. 5. Office of the Secretary of the Navy, Washington, D.C., 2105 hours, 17 November 1942. Chief Petty Officer Stanley Hansen, USN, entered without knocking the office of Captain David W. Houghton, USN, Administrative Assistant to the Secretary of the Navy, and laid a single sheet of typewriter paper on his desk.
"The Secretary said I should run that past you, Captain, before I send it," he said.
Top Secret. The Secretary of the Navy, Washington, via special channel, duplication forbidden, original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. Supreme Commander, SWEPO. Eyes only, Brigadier General F.W. Pickering, USMCR, 17 November, 1942. Following personal from SecNave for Brig Gen Pickering. Dear Fleming, I just came from a meeting with Admiral Leahy and Colonel Donovan of the OSS, in which the subjects of evaluating Fertig's guerrilla operation and its potential and OSS operations in MacArthur's SWEPO came up. I believe the meeting was held with either the knowledge of the President or at his direction. Colonel Donovan, whose detailed knowledge of your operation came from both his own sources and from Admiral Leahy, proposed the following as a means to overcome General MacArthur's reluctance to accept OSS services. He will detail 2 USMC officers presently seconded to the OSS to management analysis to participate under your command in the mission to Fertig. Donovan says both agents, a major and a captain, are highly trained in this sort of thing. He made the point that despite your high regard for Lieutenant McCoy, giving a young junior officer that level of responsibility is asking a good deal of him. Donovan's agents will not reveal their OSS connection unless and until the mission to Fertig proves successful. Had you been able to make progress with MacArthur vis-a-vis SWEPO and the OSS, and or had Colonel Stecker been available or some other senior officer, I might have declined Donovan's offer to help. Once I agreed to it, Leahy volunteered to send a special channel personal to Nimitz, guaranteeing a submarine when and where you need it. Houghton will coordinate travel arrangements, etc., vis-a-vis Donovan's people, who will report to Rickaby tomorrow. Best personal regards, Frank. End personal SecNave to Brig Gen Pickering. Houghton, Captain, USN, Administrative Assistant to SecNave. Top Secret. Houghton read it, then glanced at his watch and wrote in the time, 21:10, and handed it back to Chief Hansen.
Is he still here?
He was when he gave me that, sir.
Houghton picked up a telephone which automatically rang a similar instrument on Secretary Knox's desk.
That special channel looks fine, Mr. Secretary, he said when Knox picked up. May I show it to Colonel Rickaby?
Chief Hansen could not hear the Secretary's reply.
Have it sent, Houghton ordered. But bring that back. I'll take care of burning it.
Aye, aye, sir.
Houghton reached for another of the telephones on his desk and dialed a number from memory. It was answered on the second ring.
Liberty 72033.
Although he suspected Rickaby had good reasons for ordering the telephones at the Office of Management Analysis answered in that manner, Houghton was always annoyed when he heard the recitation of the number.
Captain Houghton for Colonel Rickaby?
Sorry, sir, the Colonel is not available at this time.
Where is he?
I am sorry, sir, I am not permitted to give out that information.
Do you recognize my name?
Yes, sir.
Get in touch with Colonel Rickaby and have him call me. I'm in my office.
Has the Colonel your number, sir?
I think he does.
Houghton said icily and hung up. The private line on Houghton's desk rang not more than 2 minutes later.
Captain Houghton?
What's on your mind, David?
Rickaby's dry, emotionless voice asked.
Something's come up. The sooner we get together, the better.
Sounds serious.
It doesn't have to be. Would it be convenient for you to come here?
Frankly, no.
Well then, where are you?
At the Foster Lafayette, General Pickering's suite.
May I come there?
Of course. Banning and Sessions are with me. Will that pose any problems?
No. And it will probably spare you having to tell them what this is all about. I'll be there in 15 minutes.
There was a click and then a dial tone. Houghton held the telephone handset in his hand, staring at it in amazement and some annoyance before replacing it in its cradle.
Colonel Fritz Rickaby, USMC, Houghton said aloud, shaking his head, having decided that nothing else need be said, hung up.
He picked up the direct line to Knox's desk, intending to ask if the secretary required anything else of him before he left the office, but there was no answer. Secretary Knox had gone home. He waited 4 or 5 minutes for Chief Hansen to return from the cryptography room with the original of Knox's message, told him,
"Thank you, Chief, and go home,"
and then folded the message in thirds and put it in his shirt pocket. Then, feeling a little foolish, he opened a drawer in his desk, took out a Colt 380 automatic pistol, and somewhat awkwardly slipped it into a leather holster on his trousers belt. Colonel Rickaby read Frank Knox's special channel personal to Pickering, made a wry face, which could have meant contempt or resignation, and then asked with a raised eyebrow and tilt of his head if he could give it to Banning and Sessions. Houghton gestured with a wave of his hand that he could. Rickaby knew that something like this would inevitably happen. He had, in fact, seen it coming when the president sent Pickering back to Australia to plead Donovan's case for the OSS to MacArthur. Rickaby had long ago come to understand that everything in Washington was politics. This meant compromise, sometimes reasonable, sometimes not, between powerful people with different agendas, sometimes noble, sometimes not, and sometimes, as in this case, based on nothing more than personal or professional egos. Rickaby knew Donovan and respected him, and he was convinced that Donovan knew as well as he did that the role the Office of Strategic Services envisioned for Europe, which in Rickaby's professional opinion was going to work, simply would not work in the Pacific. It was relatively easy to parachute agents into France or Norway or any of the other countries now occupied by the Germans. Most of the agents would be natives of those countries. They would be fluent in the language, know the country, and have contacts inside the country willing to risk their lives to further the liberation of their countries. Furnished with excellent forged identity documents, an agent fluent in the language could relatively easily lose himself in a sea of other white faces. The situation in the Pacific was different. A white face seen anywhere in territory occupied by the Japanese would stand out like a flashing lighthouse in a sea of yellow and brown faces and would be immediately suspect. The English, who had been in Singapore and Hong Kong, were now in prison camps. So were the Dutch, who had been in the Dutch East Indies, and for that matter, most of the French in French Indochina. The exception being those who could prove their loyalty to Marshal Pétain's German-allied government in Vichy. Rickaby knew the story of Captain Ralph Frelick, who had been commissioned with Fertig in the Philippines. Frelick blew up bridges, railroads, and supply depots in the face of the advancing Japanese on Luzon, and then, rather than surrender, made an incredible journey from Luzon to Hanoi in French Indochina in a 50-foot boat. On landing in Hanoi, Frelick lined up his 40 men and marched them off to report to the French authorities. Salutes were exchanged, and then the French turned Frelick and his men over to the Japanese. For most of the people in territory now occupied by the Japanese, there would be very little profit in risking one's life and the lives of one's family to fight the Japanese, especially when the result would not be liberation from occupation, but simply the reinstallation of the British or the Dutch or the French as colonial masters. There was an exception to this analysis. In intelligence, there was always an exception. And that, of course, was the Philippines. Most Filipinos did not hate the Americans who had been running their country since they took it away from the Spanish at the turn of the century. The Filipinos believed, because it happened to be true, that the United States really intended to give their country independence as soon as possible. The Philippine Army fought with great valor against the Japanese invaders, and when further resistance was impossible, they went with their American comrades-in-arms into prison camps. Meanwhile, the Japanese made the same mistake in the Philippines the Germans made in Russia. They treated the native population brutally, and so they lost any chance of cooperation, or at least docile acceptance of the occupation. Consequently, American agents sent into the Philippines would have a reasonable chance of obtaining all sorts of assistance from the Filipinos. But getting them there was going to be a problem, and so was logistics. Mindanao, closest to Australia, was not the hour or so's flight time away that France and Scandinavia were from American bases in England. Still, something could be done in the Philippines, and Donovan knew it could. But that wasn't Donovan's only motive in pushing so hard to be included in Pickering's mission to Fertig, Rickaby believed. He wanted the OSS to be involved worldwide. If the OSS was operational only in Europe, that would diminish its stature and thus the stature of Colonel William J. Donovan. Donovan was already engaged in a personal ego war with J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI. On the one hand, Hoover claimed the FBI had sole responsibility for intelligence and counterintelligence in the Western Hemisphere. On the other hand, Donovan claimed the OSS had worldwide responsibility for intelligence, counterintelligence, and special operations. Read Sabotage and Subversion. And, predictably, Roosevelt had declined to make a decision between the two of them. The result was that FBI and OSS agents in Argentina, Chile, Peru, and even Mexico spent more time fighting each other than harming the German, Italian, and Japanese axis. In Rickaby's view, not only was Pickering being used as a pawn in this political war, but as soon as he saw the special channel personal, he would know he was being used, and it would bother him a great deal. He hoped Pickering wouldn't do anything foolish. Certainly, Pickering wasn't a fool, but he was naive in the ways of Washington politics. Rickaby admired Pickering. At first, he was willing to admit, his own ego smarted when Frank Knox named Pickering chief of the Office of Management Analysis. Rickaby had built the organization from scratch over many years and had run it with some skill and success. He didn't think he needed the advice, much less the supervision of an amateur like Pickering. He had no choice, however, but to swallow his resentment, consoling himself with the thought that Pickering's flag officer's rank would be useful. In rank-conscious Washington, that was important, and Rickaby believed he could control Pickering. That did not prove necessary, for Pickering immediately made it quite clear that he considered Rickaby the expert, while he himself had some experience in a situation like this, being in charge of someone who knew more than he did. Pickering explained how the death of his father had suddenly elevated him to the office of Chairman of the Board of Pacific and Far East Shipping Corporation when he was still in his 20s. "All of a sudden, Colonel," Pickering said, "I found myself giving orders to the Commodore of Pacific and Far East Shipping Corporation's 81-ship fleet, who was not only old enough to be my father, but under whom I had sailed as a second mate." "That must have been difficult." "You're not old enough to be my father, Colonel, but I recognize your experience and expertise. So I hope to build the same kind of relationship with you I had with the Commodore." It was at that moment Rickaby realized that Pickering understood the subtleties of command. "While the responsibility for everything that happens is now mine," Pickering went on, "I am perfectly aware that you've been in charge here because you are the most experienced and competent officer available. It would therefore be foolish of me to question your judgment in any but the most extraordinary circumstances." At the time, Rickaby wondered if Pickering meant what he was saying, or was simply pouring oil on potentially troubling waters. It soon became apparent that Pickering meant what he said. Pickering rarely questioned any of Rickaby's decisions, and only once went against his strongly felt advice. In Rickaby's professional judgment, the effort and the assets required to take Lieutenant Joseph L. Howard, USMC, and Sergeant Stephen M. Koffler, USMCR, off Buka could not be militarily justified. Pickering overrode that logical conclusion on what he admitted were emotional grounds. He had learned in the trenches in France as an 18-year-old that Marines did not leave their wounded behind. He ordered the rescue operation. This episode taught both men something about the weaknesses of the other. Pickering learned that Rickaby was indeed, where necessary, absolutely ruthless, and Rickaby learned that, despite the stars on his uniform, Pickering thought like a Marine sergeant. The confrontation in no way diminished the respect and the growing affection they had begun to feel for each other. A Marine officer charged with clandestine intelligence had to be ruthless, and a Marine general officer's heartfelt concern for the welfare of a junior officer and an enlisted man could hardly be called a character flaw.
Am I permitted to ask what's going on around here? Captain Houghton asked.
The coffee table of General Pickering's suite was covered with paper. Also covered with paper was a folding card table and something like a typewriter. After a moment, he recognized it as an obsolete device cryptographic M94.
Well, for the last half hour or so, Banning has been trying to teach Sessions how to use that thing. Sessions is taking it and some other stuff to Brisbane, where he will teach McCoy how to use it. Until we make the first physical contact with Fertig, take him a decent crypto device, which Sessions will also teach McCoy to use, we have a small communications problem. Where does Fertig think McCoy should get off the submarine? When should he get off the submarine?
Yeah, Houghton said thoughtfully. What other stuff is Sessions taking over there?
Banning's been talking to a Navy psychiatrist.
Brilliant man, Banning interrupted. He certified me as sane when I came out of the Philippines, sir.
Houghton chuckled a little nervously, and then Rickaby surprised him.
That's true, he said, laughing. If I'd remembered that, I'd have sent you to another one. Anyway, he's come up with sort of a checklist, things McCoy should look for to see if Fertig might be off the rails. I also talked to some people who had guerrilla, counter-guerrilla experience in the Banana Republics, Banning said. They came up with some material, organizational material, McCoy's going to offer to Fertig.
How are you going to handle the problem of getting McCoy and the others ashore and in contact with Fertig? Houghton asked.
Well, in the final analysis, that's up to McCoy. What I'm going to recommend is that shortly before we send McCoy and Zimmerman ashore, we will send Fertig a vague message saying to expect visitors.
You heard that the secretary told General Holcomb to arrange that transfer?
Houghton interrupted.
Banning nodded and went on. To make contact with Fertig. When that's done, Fertig will contact the submarine, which will be lying offshore, with a new code McCoy will have. We'll also have a new crypto device, of course, and he can set up a place where the supplies and gold can be offloaded from the sub. How they'll get out, and when, is still up in the air.
Houghton nodded.
Maybe these OSS people will have some ideas, Banning said. We get them tomorrow?
First thing tomorrow morning.
There may be some trouble getting them over there, Rickaby said.
We laid on only one 5A priority for Sessions. Now we'll need three.
If you have any trouble, let me know.
I will, Rickaby said.
Who are these people? Have you got names? Banning asked.
Yes, I do, Houghton said.
He dug in his pocket and came up with the 3x5 card Colonel Donovan had given Secretary Knox, and which Knox had passed on to him.
Brownlee, Major James C. III, he read, and Macklin, Captain Robert B.
What was that second name?
Banning asked, incredulously.
Macklin, Captain Robert B.?
I don't believe this, Banning said.
You know him?
If it's the same guy, and I don't think there's that many Marine officers around named Macklin. Yeah, I know him, Banning said. I sent him home from China with an efficiency report endorsed by Chesty Puller that should have seen the son of a bitch kicked out of the Corps.
Tell me about him, Rickaby said coldly.
Banning delivered a 60-second précis of the multiple character flaws of Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC.
I wonder what moron promoted the son of a bitch, he observed bitterly when he was finished.
Rickaby looked thoughtful for a moment.
Captain Houghton, he said formally, If it is determined that the officer in question is indeed the one with whom Major Banning is familiar, it will be necessary to inform Colonel Donovan that he is unacceptable to us.
Christ, Fritz, I don't know,
Halton said. If he is the officer with whom Major Banning is familiar, Rickaby repeated, he is unacceptable to us. Halton shrugged.
How do we find out?
Presumably Banning will recognize him when he reports for duty, Rickaby said.
Part 10 1. USMC, Office of Management Analysis, Temporary Building T-2032, The Mall, Washington, D.C., 1105, 18 November 1942. Captain David L. Houghton, USN, walked into the office of Colonel F. L. Rickaby, USMC, and handed him a square envelope.
Sorry, Fritz, he said.
Rickaby opened the envelope and took out the single sheet of paper it contained. The Secretary of the Navy, Washington, D.C., 18 November 1942. Colonel F. L. Rickaby, USMC, USMC Office of Management Analysis, Commandant, United States Marine Corps, Washington. By hand. Dear Colonel Rickaby, inasmuch as I have been led to believe that assignment of officer personnel within the Naval Service is my responsibility, I was somewhat surprised to hear from Captain Houghton that you feel that one of the officers being seconded to you from the Office of Strategic Services is unacceptable. You are directed to carry out the operation in question with the personnel assigned to it by me. No further discussion of this issue is desired. Sincerely, Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy. Rickaby looked up at Houghton, but didn't speak.
Out of school, Fritz, Houghton said. He went right through the roof.
He doesn't want to risk a confrontation with Donovan, Rickaby said. Donovan might go to the president, accuse Knox of going back on a deal, and Knox might lose. That's what this is all about. Captain Houghton did not think it would be proper for him to reply, even though he'd had the same thought when he witnessed Knox's surprisingly angry and highly unusual response to Rickaby's request.
Well, I can always arrange to have the son of a bitch run over by a truck, Rickaby said. Don't say something like that, even as a joke, Houghton said.
Rickaby nodded, but didn't reply. Captain Houghton felt a sudden chill.
For God's sake, Fritz, I hope you were joking.
Rickaby's eyes, cold and expressionless, met Houghton's. When Major Brownlee and Captain Macklin reported to me this morning, he said, I informed them only of what they had need to know at this time. Specifically, that tentative arrangements had been made to fly them this afternoon to Pearl Harbor for further transportation to an unspecified location somewhere in the Pacific. Houghton nodded.
Captain Macklin assured me that while he was, of course, willing to go wherever ordered, he nevertheless felt obliged to inform me that not only had he not completed the training course offered by the OSS, but that he had not yet fully recovered from the wounds he suffered at Gavutu.
Really?
Really. You will see, won't you, Colonel? Personally, I mean, that Captain Macklin makes it safely to the airport?
Unfortunately, David, I am one of those people who obeys his orders. 2. Supreme Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, Brisbane, Australia, 1405 hours, 18 November, 1942. Brigadier General Fleming S. Pickering, trailed by Second Lieutenant George F. Hart, passed through the two MP-manned security posts barring entrance to the cryptographic facility of Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, and then walked down an inside corridor to an unmarked steel door leading to the special section. Hart snatched a .38 Colt snub-nosed revolver from under his tunic and rapped three times with the butt on the door. A lighter knock on the thick steel door, with the knuckles, or even with a Zippo lighter or keys or something else metallic, could not be heard inside. It was necessary to make the door ring like a drum. In a moment, a 3-by-5-inch panel in the door screeched open.
It's me, Pluto, Pickering said.
The panel screeched shut. There was the sound of metal bars sliding out of place, and then the door creaked open. Pickering and Hart entered the small room.
I didn't expect you, sir,
Major Hahn said, pulling his tie into place. He was also wearing a .45 automatic in a shoulder holster. Pickering looked past him. On a table was an open briefcase to which was attached a chain and half of a set of handcuffs.
Going somewhere, Pluto? Pickering asked. To see you, sir,
Pluto said as he closed the steel door behind Pickering and slid the bars back in place. Pickering waited. Pluto went to the briefcase and came out with a business-sized envelope. He handed it to Pickering.
That just came in, he said. I thought you'd want to see it right away.
Pickering tore open the envelope. His lips tightened.
Somehow I didn't think you were going to like that, Pluto said.
Anyone else seen this?
No, sir.
And nobody but you, Hart, and me does. Okay, Pluto?
Yes, sir.
Pickering handed Hart, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox's special channel personal, announcing that Colonel Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS, with Knox's blessing, was sending two OSS agents to participate in the Fairtig operation. Pickering's first reaction, which he immediately recognized as such, was fury.
God damn Franklin Roosevelt, he said,
and was immediately sorry. Not for the thought, but for the emotional outburst.
The one thing I cannot afford to do here is lose my temper.
Pluto and Hart looked at him in surprise.
Am I missing something here? Hart asked. Or is that one of the questions I'm not supposed to ask?
Pickering smiled.
I suppose this will come as a shock to you, as a devout Democrat, George, but our beloved commander-in-chief makes Machiavelli seem innocent as Francis of Assisi.
I never said I was a Democrat, Hart said, and I still don't understand.
There are a number...
By God, this is Machiavellian. ...of factors at play here, George.
In theory, President Roosevelt is the commander-in-chief, and MacArthur, like every other officer in a uniform, is supposed to obey without question any order received. Roosevelt wants the OSS to start operating in Sweepo. MacArthur wants nothing to do with the OSS. On the surface, the simple solution would be to simply issue the order. That is not going to happen.
Why?
He asked rhetorically.
Because Roosevelt has decided that issuing the order would not be in his best interests.
Why?
Because MacArthur, having made his feelings about the OSS known through me, is very likely to disobey that order.
Can he get away with that?
Pluto asked, not sounding very surprised.
Oh, yes, in two ways, maybe three. For one thing, he could simply ignore the order. In effect, he's already done that. The way it's supposed to work is that when the desires of the commander-in-chief are made known, everybody is supposed to jump through a hoop to see the desires satisfied. MacArthur has not yet found time in his busy schedule to even talk to Donovan's people. That's why I was sent over here this time, to sell Donovan's people to him.
What's El Supremo got against the OSS? Hart asked.
El Supremo doesn't want anything going on in his ballpark that he can't control. And he thinks, probably correctly, that he will not be able to control the OSS because Bill Donovan has the president's ear.
This is the proof of that, come to think of it, Pickering said, waving Knox's special channel personal in his hand. Hart looked confused.
I have no business explaining this to them. But on the other hand, Roosevelt and Knox had no right putting me in the middle of their chicanery.
Another seed of thought appeared in the back of his mind, quickly sprouted, blossomed, and then gave fruit.
Of course. That's what this is all about.
Or at least has a hell of a lot to do with it.
Roosevelt is one of those people who believes that if you're not with me, you're against me nonsense. If I quietly go along with this business, which would mean not telling MacArthur, deceiving MacArthur, then I will have chosen sides, joined Roosevelt's team. His political team, not his military team.
When he ordered me over here to try to sell MacArthur on the OSS as a serving officer, I had no choice but to obey my orders, even though I thought that Donovan's OSS will probably be more trouble here than they're worth, and that Bill Donovan personally is an arrogant, goddamned Democrat New York lawyer and new dealer. And Christ knows I tried to sell Donovan's people to El Supremo. I went to work for Knox to be his eyes and ears over here. While I really think I could be of more use to this war running a shipping operation, God knows I could do a better job of that than three-quarters of those chair-warming admirals in Pearl Harbor, there was a certain value to that. I think I've done some good. But I did not sign on to be a political errand boy for Knox or for Roosevelt, and that's what they're asking me to become. I'll be damned if I'll go along.
He became aware that both Pluto and Hart were waiting for him to go on.
"When in doubt, Pluto," Pickering said, "tell the truth. Write that on the palm of your hand so you don't forget it."
"Sir?"
"Let me at that phone, George," Pickering said. He squeezed past Hart, picked up a red telephone, and dialed a number. "Fleming Pickering, Sid," he said into it, telling Pluto and Hart that he had dialed MacArthur's personal number and that Lieutenant Colonel Sidney L. Huff, MacArthur's aide-de-camp, had picked up the telephone. "I would like a few minutes of the Supreme Commander's time at his earliest convenience." There was a pause. "No, Sid, squeezing me in for a minute or two at 1930 will not be satisfactory." There was another pause. "I'll tell you what you can do, Colonel," Pickering said, his voice icy. "You can speak to the Supreme Commander, relay my request to him, and then relay his reply to me." There was another pause, a longer one.
"Thank you very much, Colonel," Pickering said. "Please inform the Supreme Commander that I'm on my way up."
Hart started to slide the metal bars out of place.
"You wait for me here, George," Pickering said. "Aides-de-camp are not invited to this tete-a-tete."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Fleming, my dear fellow,"
General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander Sweepo, said, smiling and waving his hand in a come-in gesture.
"Come in! Curiosity overwhelms me. Sid said this was an emergency of some kind."
MacArthur was dressed in his customary washed-soft khakis.
"No, sir, I said nothing about an emergency. What I told Colonel Huff was that I would be grateful if you could find time for me before 7:30. "I can always make time for you, Fleming. Sid should have known that," MacArthur said. "Sid, you may leave us."
Huff looked as if he had just been kicked.
Did El Supremo sense that I didn't want Huff to hear what I have to say? Or did he do that to humiliate him and thus placate me? He's just as Machiavellian as Roosevelt, and I better not forget that.
MacArthur waved Pickering into a chair and looked at him expectantly. Pickering handed him Knox's special channel personal and then sat down. MacArthur picked up a long, thin, black cigar from an ashtray and puffed on it as he read the message twice. Then he met Pickering's eyes.
"I appreciate your loyalty in showing me this, Fleming."
"General, with all the respect I can muster, loyalty was not my motive."
"Indeed?"
"I did not want you to believe I had any part in this." "I would have known that without your telling me," MacArthur said. "Whatever terrible things may be said about you around here, no one I know has ever accused you of being devious."
Pickering found himself smiling.
"Among the things that are said about you around here is that you are mounting a supply mission to Lieutenant Colonel Fertig on Mindanao," MacArthur said. "I've been wondering when you were going to discuss this with me."
"More of a reconnaissance mission, sir," Pickering said, "to see what's really going on with him.
General Willoughby believes Fertig suffers from delusions of grandeur."
"Yes, sir, he's made that clear to me."
"I had plans, you know, Fleming, to conduct extensive guerrilla operations against the Japanese, using the material and personnel available to General Sharp's Mindanao force."
"No, sir, I did not."
"That
and a good deal else went down the toilet when the chain of command became confused. You know what I'm speaking of course?
No, sir, not exactly.
When I was ordered to leave Corregidor by the President, it was my understanding that I was simply moving my flag, not relinquishing my command and its concomitant responsibilities. I conferred with General Sharp on Mindanao, at the Dole Plantation, incidentally. Do you know it?
Yes, sir. I was a guest there many times before the war.
Lovely place.
It pains me to think of Japanese boots treading on the veranda of the main house. But I digress. I spoke with General Sharp at some length while waiting for the airplane. My orders to him were to hold on, that immediately on my arrival here I would institute a resupply operation for the Mindanao force. And, looking to the worst case, if it appeared to him that further organized resistance was not possible, to make provisions, select personnel, and cache supplies and materiel for irregular operations.
I wasn't aware of that, sir.
Oh, yes, MacArthur said. But the moment that B-17 broke ground at the Dole Plantation airstrip to bring me here, General Marshall began to communicate directly with General Wainwright on Corregidor. General Wainwright naturally assumed the chain of command had been changed, that I had been taken out of it, and that he henceforth would be getting his orders from Washington. Nothing about that was said to me then or now.
I wasn't aware of this, sir.
Few people are, MacArthur said.
When I arrived here, you were here, Fleming, you know this, I learned that I had been misled vis-a-vis the materiel and troops that would be available to me here. But I kept my word to Sharp. I drew down on the limited materiel here and instituted resupply voyages to Mindanao. Unfortunately, very little got through to him. Two small ships containing artillery and small arms ammunition and not much else. And then, when George Marshall diverted to Hawaii, supply ships already on the high seas to Australia on the grounds the risk of their loss was too great to bear, I had to terminate my efforts to resupply General Sharp's Mindanao force with the greatest reluctance.
I understand.
And then, of course, the question became moot. Bataan fell, and then Corregidor. General Homa bluffed General Wainwright. He would not agree to Wainwright's surrender unless Wainwright surrendered all U.S. troops in the Philippines. Wainwright had no authority to do that, but he thought he did, and unfortunately so did General Sharp. As soon as I heard what Wainwright had done, I radioed General Sharp to ignore any orders from Wainwright. But by then it was too late. General Sharp, as a good soldier, obeyed what he thought were his orders to surrender. As a good officer, he destroyed all the war material under his command before hoisting the white flag. All the materiel, Fleming, which could, should have been used to mount a meaningful, irregular operation against the Japanese, and the officers who would have commanded such operations, God help them, entered captivity.
MacArthur paused, took the thin black cigar from the ashtray, relit it carefully, and then met Pickering's eyes. At that point, I was forced to conclude that the mounting of effective, irregular guerrilla operations against the Japanese in the Philippine Islands was militarily impossible. I so informed General Marshall.
Yes, sir. You do understand the problem here, don't you, Fleming?
I'm not sure I take your meaning, sir.
Faith! MacArthur said dramatically. Faith! At the moment, the Filipino people have not lost their faith in me, in the United States. They believe I will return. But realistically, that faith is not very deep. It would disappear if we suffered another humiliating defeat at the hands of the Japanese. If, for example, people flocked to this Fertig chap in the belief that he was in fact a general officer of the United States Army, and then, for example, he were to be captured by the Japanese and marched in chains through the streets of Manila and executed as a common criminal, that would be playing right into the hands of the Japanese.
Yes, sir.
Abruptly, MacArthur asked, what are you going to do, Fleming, about this obnoxious intrusion of the camel's nose into your tent?
The question surprised Pickering. Obey my orders, sir. See that these people get into Mindanao and then get out. MacArthur nodded his head solemnly. This headquarters